What was that?
TSPC. We've been involved with them many times.
Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. It's Monday, February 16th. We have one work session to take care of right away. I want to open a work session on House Bill 2411. We discovered, colleagues, that this bill was referred to us perhaps by mistake. So I'm going to ask for a motion to send it to the Education Committee without recommendations so that it can be considered along with some other relevant things that the Education Committee is taking on. Representative Gallegos?
Sure. Chair Reed, I move that House Bill 2411 without recommendation to the Committee on Education.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos moves House Bill 2411 without recommendation to the House Committee on Education. Is there any discussion?
They can't talk about
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I totally support the motion. And I hope that our colleagues in House Education will look for more improvement simply than a semantical change for TSPC as they deal with this topic at their committee level. So with that, I'll be quiet.
Thank you. That's fine. I think he was talking to you, Representative Reardon.
He usually is. Yeah.
Very good. Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you. I was also hoped that Jeff would look into. I passed a bill in the 214 session that asked agencies to report back on how they've expedited licensing for vets. So you, as a veteran, you may want to ask how they're doing on that program. As part of the bill saying that, you know, we ask all these people to do it, but we don't have a report back on what's the results. You know, are vets getting their teaching certificate, or how any roadblocks or things that we can do to expedite that legislatively? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. The discussion. Are there any objections to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries, and House Bill 2411 goes to the Education Committee without recommendation. Close the work session on House Bill 2411 and open an informational meeting on workforce systems, workforce development. We're going to take our sort of orientation approach as we've done in past weeks, and start with Lisa Nissenfeld, the Director of the Employment Department. And I think we'll ask Alana Pertlegini and Karen Hummelbaugh to join you, if that's okay.
I think I'm kicking this off.
Great.
Thank you and good morning, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ilana Pertlegini. I am the governor's workforce and labor policy advisor. And I'm here mostly to give you a little bit of an idea of what the workforce system is and kind of the direction that the system has been moving in before our experts here talk about the details and the specifics that you'll need to know as you address bills this year. Our workforce system, compared to a lot of the agencies that you look at holistically, a lot of the programs that you work with on this committee, is relatively small in its budget impact, but it's got a large agency impact and a large impact on Oregonians. This is a system that is not housed within a single place, but that requires the coordination of many different agencies, generally under the leadership of the Employment Department. The CCWD, which will become HEC at some point later this year. And it has a big impact on Oregonians. Over 300,000, almost 350,000 Oregonians last year participated in the workforce system in some way. These were mostly folks from your district looking for work who couldn't find work on their own and needed some sort of retraining, retooling of their skills, help finding opportunities to get back in the job market. And then there were businesses who came to our workforce system to say, we can't find the types of workers that we need. We can't find people with the skills we need to grow our businesses and help grow the Oregon economy. So they came to the workforce system to try to find new training programs, to try to connect with Oregon workers who had the skills to help them grow. So this really is a system that does a lot for Oregon at many different levels. And it's a system that has gone through many changes recently. So in trying to better reach our goals, and we have the goals up here now, I believe. Yes? No? Or our principles. Okay, a few of our goals. We've tried to do a few things. First of all, we've tried to push decision making on how training is delivered and what training programs are needed down to the local level. You'll hear more about what the workforce system looks like, but we have local boards and regions around the state, and those boards are made up of local employers, local worker representatives, and others who have a much better idea than we do here in Salem. About what their local economies need. So we've tried to push those decisions down to that level. At the same time, we've tried to make sure that there's more accountability in what those boards are doing and what types of programs we are supporting with our workforce dollars that your colleagues on the Ways and Means Committees approve some of and that we get from the federal government as well. We've tried to ensure that our employers are leading the strategies to create new training programs and to grow our economies. We need to be hearing from employers what steps are next, what directions their businesses are growing in, so that we know that as workers go into training programs, they're coming out with the skills that will actually land them a job and not with a nice piece of paper that doesn't actually lead to a nice paycheck at the end of the next month. And we're making sure that we're optimizing our resources. The workforce system is an area that is perennially underfunded. Much of that money, like I said, comes from the federal government. There is some that is moved around and allocated here as well, but there's never enough funding to reach all of the Oregonians that we'd like to be able to help. So we've tried to set about and find new ways that we can make sure that that funding is being used most effectively. Oregon undertook a new strategic plan just over a year ago. To try to move us in a more effective direction. That plan was closely followed by some federal changes. We have a new workforce policy that we're moving toward under the federal government. Luckily, our plan and our changes moved in the same direction that the feds want us to be moving. But we really are trying to look at how to get the best value for Oregonians through high-quality training, through jobs in growing industries, through training that will lead to options, not just a single job, but an industry cluster in an area so that you have more than just one opportunity, and through ensuring that we have a workforce that can grow with the businesses in our state. So these changes are guided by OWIB, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. Which is a state-level board. This is a governor-appointed board that does a few things. First of all, I said we're trying to make sure that this system is a little bit more accountable, and that accountability comes from OWIB. OWIB sets the high-level standards that our local boards look at as they make decisions. OWIB says we need to be looking at things like industry clusters. You decide at the local level what those clusters are in your area, but make sure you're finding industry clusters. OWIB says we need to be doing things like ensuring that we are raising the average wage in Oregon. You look at what that wage is in your region, but make sure that we're helping grow our economy in that direction. OWIB holds our partners accountable for results. So OWIB says make sure that you're working with training partners who can provide quality education with a certificate at the end or not, depending on the standards that are set. You find those partners, but we'll make sure that they're meeting the standards that the state has set through OWIB for those training programs. And then OWIB also recommends policies to the governor. So as we move this system forward and work through these changes, OWIB, which is made up over 50% of employers, also has representatives of the workforce, also has representatives of our agencies, our experts in these systems, is coming to the governor to say, here's what we need on the ground. Here's how these policies need to look. And then provides feedback to the agencies on how that's actually working and to our local boards on how these policies are working. So you'll be hearing from a number of people today about what this looks like on the ground. I'm happy to take any questions about the changes in direction that the system is moving in.
Very good. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot, I'm confused by something you just said a little bit ago. You said that OIB is instructing or encouraging local boards to raise wages at the local level. That doesn't really seem like a...
Chair Reed, Representative,
that's... decree from on high. I mean, that's a result of economic growth and obviously prosperity within those businesses at the local level, wouldn't it be?
Chair Reed, Representative Johnson, maybe I wasn't clear. That was an example of the type of standard that OWIB could set. So OWIB could say, for example, we need to be looking at sector strategies, which OWIB has said in the past. OWIB could say, for example, we need to be training workers for jobs that pay, you know, the average wage in the region or above, as opposed to jobs that pay below the average wage. OWIB could set standards around various education attainment levels. Those are examples of the types of standards OWIB could set, and then they say to the local boards, you figure out what that means in your region, because that means a different thing in your district than it means in Representative Reardon's district or Representative McEwen's district, and how you go about finding the partners to work with to create the type of workforce system we want to see in this state.
Please.
I can understand the ideal of wanting to set standards, but again, from folks at the local level, I believe throughout the state, they're actively engaged in wanting to do that already. I don't think they need an edict from the state to tell them to try to raise up your workforce and to look for those better paying occupational opportunities. It's a part of how life happens at the local level.
Correct, Chair Reed, Representative Johnson. Like I said, that was one example of the type of standard they could set, not something that the board is actively looking at or that they have written in stone, but just to give you a series of ideas of when we talk about high level standards that could be implemented in many different ways at the local level, what that could look like.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, who's next, please?
Good morning, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Neisenfeld. I'm the director of the Oregon Employment Department. And I want to talk about, first, sort of the background of why we have a sense of urgency around what's happening in our workforce. First of all, God willing, the baby boomers are retiring. At least I hope I am. And at the same time, we're seeing an increased demand for skills with employers. As you all know, technology has changed the need for training. When I started in workforce in the 70s, our marching orders were to go out and find jobs that paid well but required no skills. Those jobs are long gone. So jobs that remain in this country require an increased level of skills over what we've had. And when you couple that with the baby boom retiring and the baby boom having essentially taken the upper tiers of jobs in the workforce for quite some time, as well as many others, we have a skills gap. In addition, we see about 25% fewer youth having had any work experience when they leave school, whether that's high school or college, when they join the workforce. And that's because of many things, but particularly due to the last recession, which wiped out any chance of working that young people had. Those jobs that they normally would have gotten were taken by older folks who were just trying to survive through the recession. And frankly, also more young people are very, very busy in school, much busier than when I was in school. We're seeing people who hold jobs for a shorter period of time. In the manufacturing industry, the average tenure is 4 years right now. In the past, companies would do a lot of internal training because they knew they would be holding on to those employees for decades, and that's no longer true in our workforce. Also, a huge percentage of jobs, 30%, are now temporary or contract or freelance. That's a new wrinkle. Now, that doesn't, people don't come out of high school and go into that itinerant workforce except in temp jobs. Before they become freelancers, they'll have some kind of regular job. But finally, jobs are also less place-based. We have a little typo there. So that work that formerly we regarded as had to be done locally, let's say architecture, can now be done anywhere in the world via internet and other technologies. So skills are the key issue that we're facing as we try to grow the economy of the state of Oregon. I had dinner with an economic development friend a few weeks ago, and her response when I asked her if workforce was still a big issue in economic development, because things come and go, she says, yes, it is the number one issue, it's the number two issue, and it's the number three issue. So this is keeping our companies who are already here from growing, finding the right workers, and it's also keeping companies who might want to locate here thinking twice about whether this is the right place for them. The goals of the workforce system are that Oregonians are able to work in jobs that will provide a living for their families, that businesses have the workers they need to survive and grow, and that we're making the best use of all public resources to pull this off. So they're pretty simple. We're often asked which is more important, the job seeker or the employer. And frankly, you have to have both in order to have an employer. They have to have employees. So we've got to work both sides of that equation. Next, I'm going to go through a list of who does what in the workforce system, just to try and give you an overview. This slide, you're going to see repeated after each. We're going to go through each population that we work with in workforce, and then the organizations or types of organizations that are not principally involved in these areas will be grayed out. You'll see in color the ones that are involved. I want to emphasize at this point that we've kind of used the 80-20 rule here. There are many exceptions to how the system works, but this is basically how it works from the point of view of key populations. So this is a simple stratification, again, not a perfect paradigm, but it shows the basic types of populations we need to address in the workforce system. In the workforce system, we can't say that working with the very low-skilled is more important than working with the super-skilled. We have to have all of these jobs, all of these, we have to address all these issues in order to have a healthy economy. Some of them government is more involved in, and some more the private and nonprofit sector, some higher ed, and some others. But so for those with very low skills, we're talking about people who are living in poverty, high school dropouts, teen parents, people who may have recently left prison, many issues involved. There are a variety of strategies that are used to work with these folks, and we're just listing a few examples here. The organizations principally involved here are community colleges, school districts, alternative schools, and education service districts, as well as community-based organizations and the rest of the workforce system you see in the right-hand column. I want to emphasize that WorkSource Oregon is a joint venture between local workforce investment boards and the Oregon Employment Department. It's not one or the other. It is a joint venture and something dictated by the Workforce Investment Act. Now that's turning into the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. OED and DHS also have other pieces of the system. DHS has the systems, of course, that work with very low-income individuals, as well as Voc Rehab. And then the Commission for the Blind is one more of the state agencies that's involved in working with this population. For entry level and youth, we find these are typically folks with no work experience, but a bright future ahead. Many times immigrants are in this category. And again, a variety of programs. I'm not going to read them to you, but you can see the types of things that go on with entry level and youth. The organizations involved, in this case, businesses included, because they're very important partners in providing internships, mentorships, and unskilled jobs, entry-level jobs for those folks. Again, you'll see a variety of players involved. The key here is to not leave people stranded at entry level. And that is often what we do. That's a huge challenge in our system right now, where people, we do start them on the pathway to prosperity, but they tend to stay there. And so that's one of the challenges we're addressing right now. The underemployed, I'm sure you all know people who lost a job, particularly in the Great Recession. A member of my family lost a job then and is now working at a minimum wage job full-time just in order to keep kind of food on the table. These are people who have many skills. They are also recent college graduates who are working to fill that period of time before they really catch on in their chosen field. So this population is served by many different entities. You'll see on the left side of the page here that there are a variety of organizations very interested in this population, although it's a little more challenging for older workers. So you'll see many players there.
Excuse me just a second, Representative McEwen.
Chair Reed, thank you. Lisa, how are you defining older worker in that context of the example that you just gave us?
You know, I'm not sure exactly how the feds define it. I define it as over 55.
Okay. It's not the 30-somethings who are struggling because of coming out of the recession at the time when they were finishing their education.
No, Chair Representative McCann, it's typically those who are really having a tough time being competitive with younger workers.
Okay. Thank you.
The middle 40, and again, we're talking here about the 40-40-20 numbers, which I'm sure are ever-present in your brains. And also, those are the folks who are in technical skilled areas. People in the trades, many people in the middle jobs in healthcare, in engineering, frontline supervisors. Training for these jobs is front and center of what we do both at community colleges and in the workforce investment boards and at WorkSource, trying to connect these things. They're typically credentialed training, whether they're on the job and credentialed, such as apprenticeship, or classroom-based and credentialed, or a combination of those two, which apprenticeship is as well. Organizations involved in the middle 40, and we probably should have lit up business there because they are highly involved. You'll see staffing and employment agencies stepping to the front here. We also, school districts should also have been lit up here because they teach CTE classes, which lead to those technical skills. I would also like to mention that apprenticeship, people often think of apprenticeship as only the skilled trades, particularly in construction. But in fact, we're working with Boley right now on looking at apprenticeship in non-traditional occupations, things in hospitals and manufacturing that have not been apprenticeable trades before. But it's a really cost-effective, employer-centric way of training. We have a group now looking at seeing if sewing skills for industry could be connected there. So the coming years, I think you'll see us working on that very hard because apprenticeship by far is our most cost-effective training strategy. The professional and upper 40 strata, these are typically four-year degreed occupations. These are the bread and butter of many companies, particularly in information technologies and in the growing parts of our economy. Here, distance learning may be a game changer of where we are able to educate more people there, but the college is working hard on that. We are very encouraged by the legislation on the Oregon Talent Council. We believe it provides us a tool as a system to grow our ability to work with industry in these upper sectors, along with the colleges and universities.
Question.
Representative Reardon.
This is nothing, reflects nothing on what you're saying at all, but I just found that word upper really annoying this morning, and because In what way is that meant? Is it meant as in upper income, upper, is it superior to middle, something like that? And it's just really, it's bothering me. It's never bothered me because we've used those, you know, the 20-40-40 thing for ages. And I don't know why it struck me this morning, but I think part of it, in my mind anyway, is you can certainly have equal or better income and benefits in that middle group. So I'm going on record right now as I want to change that. To
Representative Reed and Representative Reardon, I absolutely agree that the jobs in middle skills provide an equally strong potential for living and income. And in fact, we need to double down on our efforts to convince families, teachers, and others that these are not only well-paying occupations, but honorable and important, critical. Our young people have an idea that manufacturing is disappearing or that agriculture is somehow not clean or getting your hands dirty is inappropriate. So we totally agree with you on that. We're simply referring to the upper 40 in the 40-40-20 thing.
Educational goals, perhaps.
Thank you. So there's no judgment involved in that, because I think that is one of our biggest challenges with the middle 40 is making that happen, making the helping people understand their importance.
We're in total agreement. Okay. Thank you.
The final group is the super skilled, and we kind of laugh about this one because one of my favorites in this list are the astrophysicists. But
legislators are not on this list.
For good reason.
Yeah, there was some laughter involved.
Yes.
People get paid.
Yeah, that's true too.
For these jobs, often you just need one or two of them in order to allow an entire company to exist. Astrophysicists being one of my favorites. We have some semiconductor companies in this region that make laser semiconductors that require astrophysicists. Who knew? And if you have those people with those skills, then you can have the other 200 people in the company. But absent them, you're in deep trouble. We put in the same category entrepreneurs and those who are looking at globally competitive businesses as opposed to entrepreneurs who do service level businesses. So this is a very important category. Again, no one category is more important than another to the workforce, but this one has very few organizations working toward it, but they do so in a very concentrated way. The staffing and employment agencies, by the way, we're including those who simply are recruiting people from outside the state, bringing that talent into Oregon. But this is a huge economic development issue and a big issue for business, as well as our colleges and universities. Okay. So next I want to talk about the state roles in workforce development, just so you'll understand how our various state agencies, for the most part, are involved. And there are other state agencies who have some role. For example, ODOT has some workforce programs that relate to their transportation contracts, but these are the main players listed here. Corrections also has some workforce programs. OED is... we have our portion of WorkSource, which is in our Business and Employment Services unit. We also run the Unemployment Insurance Program. We operate the Trade Act program, which is a program that helps fund individuals who have lost their jobs due to international trade imbalances. And we also have one of the nation's finest research departments, which I'm sure that you see their data on a regular basis. We also have, then, a joint department with CCWD, soon to become the HEC. It's an interagency unit. We call it the PIE, Policy, Innovation, and Evaluation. Karen Hummelbaugh, to my left, heads that committee, that unit. They do the grant administration for the Workforce Investment Act, soon to become the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, WIOA. They staff the OIB. And there are a variety of special projects they undertake. They're essentially the R&D section for the workforce system of looking ahead and trying to figure out where we need to go next and what the important pieces are. System planning and evaluation is also another important piece. The HEC, you know, provides oversight and coordination between universities, community colleges, the Scholarship Commission, private colleges, and they also have a research and data department. CCWD has then these other functions that remain at the HEC. I've mentioned apprenticeship. BOLI and their apprenticeship programs are an important part of the workforce system. And then DHS, they have self-sufficiency programs, and voc rehab are their two biggest components that are involved in the workforce system. We work with them regularly to try and make those programs more aligned. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. And finally, the Commission for the Blind. All of these programs feed into the local systems. There are very few of these programs that deliver services directly. We have a piece of the WorkSource program delivery, but that piece is led by those local boards and local priorities. As you also well know, community colleges are led by local boards and governed by those local boards, and their economic development organizations, both inside and outside of state government. And then all of us work with the community organizations. Any questions or comments?
Representative Hayden.
Jerry. Thank you. I do have a question coming back to graduation rates is tied in here. I've had the opportunity, because I enjoy doing it since 1986, working fighting forest fires with heavy equipment. And I've often wondered and tried. We actually have a program locally that we try and engage with our local high schools. Every year we spend 2 weeks training youth or older, less skilled people to come in. We give a free two-week training course, and they end up getting a fire card at the end of that so they can come out for short-term employment. These fire camps out there are really mini towns. They have every different type. They have medical clinics there. They have food service clinics there. They have parking, valet types of things. They have housing. They have pretty much every aspect of our community, and they set up for about 3 months and are funded. Within that, there is a lot of jobs that don't go filled because every piece of equipment is allowed to have a spotter or a safety, but the reimbursement rate is so low you can't afford to pay a $50 an hour operator to fill that position. And so a lot of our contractors just opt out. And I've often wondered why the employment department or somebody, and I don't see the Oregon Department of Forestry on there, why they don't set up some sort of pool to incentivize our youth. If they graduate from high school, they would be qualified to get into this work pool the next summer. Once they get into the work pool, they could choose many, many different areas in these mini camps that last for about 90 days, and they could work at a pretty good wage. I mean, it's not enough wage to cover $50 an hour, but we hire coming into that at about $20 an hour for a high school student. I mean, that's some pretty good wages for them. And there's just a ton of jobs in these fire camps that aren't filled because the reimbursement rate isn't enough for a skilled worker, but it's a great entry level for older workers that want to come back in and reengage. So the question is, we've tried to engage locally to find a workforce or something set up. It wouldn't cost much to set up a workforce, but just so these commercial companies could go to and say, I need somebody, you know, for 90 days for the fire season. I think there's thousands of jobs sitting out there that we could tap into. Your comment on that. And if there is such a program, I'd like to know so I could tell my high schools in my district, which is very rural, because it's a big problem finding work for them.
Chair Reed and Representative Hayden, members of the committee, I don't know the answer to your question, and I will look into it and get back to you on that.
Okay.
I do know that as the workforce tightens, we're going to have continued problems. We are already seeing them in agriculture, in getting workers, particularly for jobs that might be regarded as challenging and away from home. But we will I will look into that and get back to you directly.
Representative Gagas has a question.
Yes. Actually, I've got 3 points that I wanted to raise.
one with regard to the baby, going back to the demographics that you started out talking about, and baby boomers, communities of color, and undocumented workers. So those three points, I think, to begin with, the baby boom generation, my sense is, I mean, when we talk about minimum wage or low wages, we talk about them as being entry level for teenagers, ways to get experience and so on. But as you were mentioning, retiring baby boomers, frankly, I think many of them are not going to be able to afford to retire and just live off Social Security. So I think that I anticipate that we're going to have more and more seniors taking low wage jobs simply as a way to supplement that Social Security income. And I don't know if you're taking that kind of effect into account. As far as the communities of color, almost 25% of the state's population are people of color. And it's not so much the ethnic difference, but it really is the age difference that I think is important for workforce development. The median age for people of color in the state is 30, as opposed to the white population, which their age is 40. So if you think about that in terms of workforce, and if you think about if the median age is 30, that means half that population is under 30, and again accounts for a surge in terms of the population that will be our workforce in the next 10 years, 5 years. So I guess what I'm asking about is how you're taking those kinds of demographics into account. And then the final piece is really the undocumented workers. We know there's thousands of people here who are undocumented and are part of our workforce, yet we sort of pretend like they don't exist. Legally, institutionally, it's like there's blinders. And I think, how do we take that kind of workforce element into account? So those are my three questions.
Just three small ones.
Yeah. Representative Gallegos, members of the committee, I'm not even sure where to start. In terms of undocumented workers, of course, there are many challenges in federal law in allowing WorkSource and the colleges to provide any kind of financial assistance to in training undocumented workers. So that is a big challenge in and of itself. We rely on our local partners to really look at the demographics of each of their communities. We don't, and I'll get to that in a little bit in my presentation about targeted populations. But we don't, as a state, dictate anything other than that they will look at targeted populations. But they're the ones who are going to have to figure out who those are and what those dynamics are in their own communities. So we have less of a role in that than. I used to work at the local level. That's where you really where it matters, and in terms of that kind of targeting.
Yes,
I just want to point out you're right about the undocumented issue with regard to federal law, but I would say that somehow we're anticipating getting around federal law with our marijuana, recreational marijuana. So I'm not sure what the holdup is, but thank you.
Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Reed. And Ms. Neisenfeld, thanks for the presentation. I think that the Employment Department's kind of in a unique position as far as the other workforce development partners in that you have the opportunity to hold the stick over some people. I presume that many, if not all, of the people that come to you as customers or whatever, something like that, are unemployed, and so they're seeking benefits. And so, and I know that there's some opportunities for you to hold a stick over them. Do you do that? Do you have anything that you do that, or are there any opportunities there to do that, to say, look, you're not fully making full use of yourself. You need to get up off the couch and do that. I mean, that's not every person, but I'm sure there's some like that, and your organization's in a kind of in a unique opportunity. If I run a community college, I can't go grab people off the street and drag them in or anything like that.
So. Chair Reed and Representative Nierman, yes, we require everyone receiving unemployment benefits to report to WorkSource and work on what that next job is. Our job as an agency is getting people to work, whether they're on unemployment or just a member of the public coming into WorkSource. So that is a huge effort on our part. as you can imagine, if a person really doesn't want to work, there aren't very many employers who want to hire that person. We do have many unemployment insurance strategies around helping them get back to work in an occupation for which they're suited. And if we can demonstrate that they are routinely rejecting jobs for which they're qualified and which meet their wage needs, then we can withhold unemployment insurance. As you can imagine, that's also very difficult to prove, but it is one of the tools in our toolbox.
Thank you.
Oh, Representative Johnson, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lisa, you mentioned in your report that you believe apprenticeship is the most cost-effective strategy to get workers into the workforce. I've served on the interim task force for apprenticeship during the interim and so forth, along with Rep. McEwen and a couple other legislators, a lot of industry folks, and we agree there's a lot of fruit there to be gleaned, but we have some work left to do, but it's one of the conclusions we've come up with after studying this for years, that the pipeline that allows candidates to enter apprenticeship is not large enough. I just wonder if you all at the agency or department have had any thoughts about what could be done to increase that, because it's, if we have programs and so forth, that's great, but if we're not able to get enough people through and actually out to where they can be employable, we're missing a lot of opportunities here.
Yes, Chair Reed and Representative Johnson. We have boatloads of data showing apprenticeship as the absolute most cost-effective training strategy. And so, therefore, we are in the process of hiring an individual who will be an OED employee, and they will sit at Boley and connect WorkSource applicants and others to possible apprenticeship efforts. They'll also be training every WorkSource staff person in recognizing who might be an appropriate person to sign up for the trades and the various models of apprenticeship opportunities, because there's different models for different trades. We will also be training all of our employer services people on how to spot occupations which might be apprenticeable. So I think we will be having a large effort. We're also hope to be applying for a federal grant that would assist in this matter, but whether we get that grant or not, we will be pursuing this as a major effort in the coming years.
Thank you.
I wonder, Representative Rudin, if you wouldn't mind holding on. I feel like we're getting Ms. Neisfeld off her slides for quite a bit.
It'd be fine.
Okay. Let's wait till you're through, and then I'm sure we have some more questions. Thanks.
Okay. Last spring, the Employment Department and the local workforce investment boards undertook a variety of forums around the state with employers and with workforce partners. Those are educators, local community-based organizations, and those directly in the workforce business. We had over 700 participants, and we also surveyed our job seekers through the WorkSource system, got a variety of data out of this process. First, the employer insights, and this won't come as a surprise to anyone, that applicants lack basic skills, technical skills, early work experience, and work readiness skills. These were themes over and over and over again. Now, some of them have been themes forever. I mean, I believe Plato noted that people were complaining about the younger generation. But this is also bolstered by that fact of 25% fewer youth having worked when they enter the workforce out of school. So if you don't know that a note from mom will not suffice when you don't show up that day of work and that will get you fired, you're in trouble. And there are the very fundamental skills that mostly people learn by working. Very difficult to teach work ethic in a classroom. You learn it through your early jobs. Employers in rural areas face even more challenges. We see, in order to patch together a living, that people hold multiple jobs. And so for us to focus on it as if it's just a single, here it is, here's your job, doesn't work as well in rural areas. Of course, there are longer commute times required, which also means transportation demands. And It was interesting to also hear in those areas a lot of schools talking about how none of the young people believe there are going to be jobs in that area, and so they go to the city to get further education. But at the same time, those areas have many unfilled jobs, particularly in the professional levels. So we have a mismatch there. Again, a number of unsurprising challenges and opportunities. We believe some of the opportunities can be more internships and greater innovation in getting young people engaged in work while they're in high school, whether those are through CTE classes or other activities. We believe also that we can help young people become more aware of those opportunities. We have approximately 24 research staff deployed around the state, and together with our local workforce investment boards, we are deploying them into local high schools to talk about what those local opportunities are going to look like in that particular region. So again, an enhanced CTE is another strategy that really needs to occur here. The priorities for the system, and this is really about where we are headed in the coming years. We acknowledged in our forums that the job search function of the National Employment Service, of which OED is a part, has remained essentially unchanged for 80 years, and that technology has now overtaken that job search function. There are many highly complex job search tools out there. And we heard back from employers that, yes, there are more things you need to do than just helping match people with jobs. You need to get closer alignment with training and get more people into training. So we also heard we need to improve our WorkSource services to add that additional value and outcome-based programs. And so it's no longer just, did you get a job, but are you moving up the income scale? We are going to increase our sector-based training investment. Karen's going to talk about that in a minute. We are also, as OED, retooling our unemployment insurance programs through a lean process, trying to become much more efficient. We're also looking to plan for recessions. That doesn't mean we're planning the next recession, but that we want to be prepared for it. Typically, we find that a recession comes and we act as if it's a natural disaster that we never possibly anticipated, and our backs are against the wall. We lose all institutional memory. We're slammed because so many people filing for unemployment insurance and coming into the centers, but we don't have a plan for what we're going to do with them at that time. So right now, we are undertaking that process so that we can act a little bit more responsibly with our public resources. Finally, that adding more training to the system, so increasing that training capacity is a huge priority that we heard from all over the state. So you'll notice that our budget highlights a one-time opportunity to address some of these training challenges through funding coming in to CCWD or the HEC that would be for workforce projects that would begin to address these challenges, particularly in those individuals and regions that have been left behind by the economic recovery. So as we get closer to that, we would be happy to talk more about that with you. And now I'm going to turn it over to Karen.
Thank you.
Let me check in with Representative Reardon for his question before you're too far behind.
Wonderful work. What I was looking for is I've seen nothing to strategies around veterans, and yet veterans come back. They're so well trained. Maybe some of their skills don't exactly apply to the industry, but many great skills, no teamwork, and all those soft skills. Are there strategies, or how do you coordinate with the VA, perhaps? Or
yes, Chair Reed and Representative Reardon. We have a network of representatives in the WorkSource centers who deal exclusively with vets. They are limited to working with vets who show some sort of disability. That's most vets these days, but that's a new federal wrinkle for us. They work very closely with the VA. We have the U.S. federal VA reps, workforce reps, are in our building and also coordinate very closely with us. And then local partners also have programs specifically for vets. So it's an area particularly ripe for apprenticeship and for connection with apprenticeship, particularly if we can find some ways to help people. The state of Washington's done a ton of work on this, of how you crosswalk the skills you learned in the military with those certifications into the same certifications required of certain occupations. And so we're hoping to steal that work and do that.
Great. Thank you.
Please.
All right. Representative Reed, members of the committee, my name is Karen Hummelbaugh. I am the Workforce Division Director at the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, soon to be the HEC. And also, as Lisa talked about, I am heading up this interagency collaborative for planning, innovation, and evaluation at the Employment Department. And that fits on a business card, right? So Lisa talked about the critical issue of skills, and now we're moving into the critical issue of investment and talking about how do we invest more in particularly our individuals and communities that were left behind by the economic recovery, the youth, the lower skilled adults, our rural communities. And we want to focus some additional funding on more training for our customers. The key to all of this is going to be that we have locally and industry-driven training that we're delivering. We have a package in our budget that is in the HEC budget that is talking about a continued investment in the local workforce investment boards. Those boards currently are providing programs such as the Back to Work Oregon program, which is an on-the-job training program where individuals are placed and then they're able to work. You'll hear a little bit more about this actually from an employer later, but they're able to work and then receive wages while they're in that program. We've also have an investment in our local workforce boards in certifying counties as work ready to use as an economic development tool to recruit additional businesses into the community. We have an investment in the National Career Readiness Certificate, which is a work-based certification that is recognized nationwide. And we have local strategies that increase community and industry competitiveness. So there's an investment there for the local workforce boards. There's also an investment in youth. We have sort of two main programs that serve youth. One is through the local workforce investment boards, particularly to summer and school year opportunities. And we also have the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, which combines education, conservation work out into forest and outdoors, and also work. All of these opportunities provide wages for youth, which is critical. Talking about the work experience that they need when they're unable to get sort of a more traditional work experience. It also helps lead to high school completion for many of the students that are in these programs. They are probably at risk for not completing, and this is an avenue in which they can. And also it's the beginning of a career path for continued education for many of them. And our final kind of tier of this investment package is for an investment in our incumbent workers. So we know that we have in the past had a federally funded employer workforce training fund where we actually gave businesses grants at the local level in order to help workers move up into other jobs within their company. So providing skills for supervision or leadership or even bilingual trainings sometimes or lean. And those businesses were then able to move up their incumbent workers into a higher tier with those skills, but also provide some entry-level positions that those folks vacated and other people were able to get employed.
Representative Wisdom.
Thank you. Mrs. Hummelbaum?
Yes.
In this committee last session, OICC is a great program. Mm-hmm. Like everyone likes it. That program's taken away jobs from people in my district that do contract firefighting work. I asked the agency or the council last year to look into seeing if we could work together in employing some of these contract fighting crews that train. I'm sorry that Representative Hayden left, but that's a big business in Central Oregon, and it's also in the Lane County and other counties that have contract firefighting crews. And part of their work is restoration of forests, too. So I'd really like to see, I don't know how many jobs. I didn't look at the budget that close last session. I am a Ways and Means this session. So I don't want to kill the program, but I don't know how many people you're using to train them for out in the woods, but there is a private sector in my district that does that.
Chair Reed, representative and members of the committee, I'd be happy to talk to you offline and get you some information about that, but I'm sure that there are ways in which we can definitely partner with the local communities in a different way. The OICC program is relatively small and budgetarily very small. I think it's about $2.3 million per biennium, but and it provides both school and summer programs. But certainly, I think that deserves a conversation in how we can coordinate.
Thank you.
All right, so let's move on to talking a little bit about something we call industry sector strategies. And really, this is just the foundation of how we want to address our skill shortage. It's a way to bring businesses, communities, and providers together in a conversation. And it just changes the way we engage with folks in the work we do. Industry sector strategies are locally driven. They are partnerships of both industry, education, and training. They are highly responsive to industry demand when compared to traditional job matching. So we are not just sort of trying to align things and guessing and hoping that we're making alignment. It's actually asking the industry, what do you need and how can we provide that for you? So it's problem-oriented and not program-oriented. And or solution-oriented, not program-oriented, and industries collectively versus individually. So this is about bringing together the entire industry, not just one company, and saying, what needs can we get to you collectively? This increases our bandwidth and our ability to get a better return on our investment for our training dollars. We also want to focus particularly, and we talked about this already, on experiential learning and work-based learning through on-the-job training, where you can earn a wage while you're learning, through apprenticeship, although we want to broaden the type and number of apprenticeships we have. We want to explore the opportunity for shorter-term certifications and licensures versus sort of the traditional avenues for those. And we want to make sure that as we're doing all of these things, we have a focus on rural Oregonians and their access to training that meets their geographic and community needs that is different than the urban areas. So this slide essentially is showing you both the growth and replacement openings that we have in industry for the next 10 years or so. We're a little bit into this chart. But it's really showing you that 3 out of 5 of these industry growth and replacement openings are expected to come from replacement, not necessarily growth, because of the baby boom and the retirements. And you can see that health services, professional and business services, retail, trade, manufacturing, construction, are some of the top places where we know we are going to have both growth and replacement openings over the next 10 years or so. And it's important that we use this sector strategy in order to ask those industries what we can do to fill those replacements so that we're not caught behind. I know Lisa often talks about, and I hope you're not getting ready to talk about this and I'm going to take it from you, but she talks about preparing for the next recession or preparing for the growth. And really, we don't do a good job of getting ahead of this, but looking at this data, we really want to talk to the industries and get ahead of filling those positions ahead.
Real quick, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wizard.
Thank you. Why did you combine education and health service? Why didn't you break those up?
I'm not sure if I know.
Chair Reed and Vice Chair Wisnett, that's how the Bureau of Labor Statistics divides them.
Because I think that's two of our largest employers, and it should be. I mean, I'd like to see if there's any difference in one or the other. But that came from a federal charter or something.
Yeah, it's data that we collect, but it's for, it's based on the federal template.
So thank you.
Mm-hmm. One of the challenges, all of those, I suppose, you could slice and dice in different ways. But that's a good point.
Well, that's it's an excellent point because that's really the reason why we want to have these local conversations, because just looking at the data straight up doesn't always tell you the whole picture, and it certainly doesn't always match what's happening in every community individually. We really need to talk to those businesses. When we talk about the coding for something like information technology and the jobs that show up under that, they could be in healthcare, they could be in manufacturing, they could be in agriculture, because everybody needs IT assistance. So even though it's coded that way, it doesn't necessarily describe what the conversation is is in your local community and what needs to happen in order to train folks up for those jobs. Okay. So we talk a lot about career and technical education, but we just want to kind of put a highlight on it right now and talk about jobs that require sort of more than a high school education, less than a four-year degree. They make up the largest segment of our economy. Representative Rudin kind of alluded to this when we were talking about middle 40 and the upper 40, which I think is a great point and want to be cognizant of. But career and technical education really gets folks into those middle 40 jobs, and it helps to align high school with college in a vast number of occupations. It results in actual degrees, certifications, licensures for folks, and it prepares students to get directly into employment instead of sort of hanging out there trying to figure out where they're going to become employed, which it often happens, particularly with four-year degrees, I think. The example of occupations you can see there, but it's very wide and vast what occupations that career and technical education can lead to. And this is just a pictorial for you to see, but this we just wanted to show that this is a continuum of education and skill development. It's not a you jump on the path one place and you just jump off or you jump straight into a job. There are a lot of different things, and this kind of goes with the other chart that shows that there are many organizations that are working on this and towards the goal. But the goal really is to get Oregonians employed in good jobs where they can contribute back to their communities and to really grow those economies locally.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. If you, Ilana and I are going to step back, unless you have questions for us.
I have one question that I'm not sure who it's best directed to. I was particularly struck by the stat you had, Lisa, that indicated 30%, and I expect the number is growing, of jobs are contract, temporary, freelance sort of stuff. To what degree does the data that we're using and gathering reflect that? What are the challenges? Are we getting an accurate picture of what's happening in the world because of that?
Chair Reed, that is a really, really good question, because those numbers typically show up as employees of those staffing agencies and not in the other areas.
Right, so we don't know who's actually working.
So it's very challenging to discern. Which is one of the reasons we need to be in constant conversation with those agencies, is to understand. We believe it's largely manufacturing and office occupations. We have a similar challenge in discerning data about information technology occupations. More than half of them are not in information technology firms. They're in government, education, footwear, I mean, you name it. So it's one of the many anomalies of the data we have, and why we can't simply look at data and prescribe how many seats in a training program we need. We really have to be in constant conversation with the industries themselves. Many of those temp occupations, however, I'd like to underline, work on a temp to perm function. So they're the front door of getting into a company, typically a manufacturing company. And in the better cases, the person might work there for 10 weeks, and if successful, then be taken on as a full-time regular employee. We have heard anecdotally that nationally that's happening, that transition is happening a little bit less. But I believe as the competition for workers increases, we'll see employers have to get more competitive with their practices.
Thank you.
That was my point. The question I had, Director, is does that statistic include government employees? Because I think that would skew it, you know, that would skew it one way or the other. I wouldn't see, you know, employees working for the government to be temporary contractor freelancing. So,
Vice Chair Wisnett, I do not believe it includes government, because government. Those numbers are typically counted directly as government. We report them directly as government.
One final comment or question. I really am quite serious about the immigration issue and about the undocumented. I mean, it is a critical element in our workforce, and simply to disregard it as not existing is absurd. I know Boley keeps numbers, but what does it mean in terms of our workforce needs, or how is that population filling our workforce needs and so on. So I think I'd like to, we could take that offline sometime, but I really would like to follow up on that.
Yes, Chair Reed and Vice Chair Gayes, we'd be very interested in talking about it. We also do operate the H-2A program, which is the guest worker program, principally for agriculture. But again, as the workforce tightens up, there are many, many issues that need further discussion.
Thank you.
We appreciate that.
Thank you both for being here. We're going to make a little transition. Lisa's staying where she is, I think, and we're going to she's going to be joined by Christina Payne from Lane Workforce Partnership and Jennifer Adams from Bulk Handling Systems. Sort of the local workforce investment perspective.
Wait, let me do this one, and then we'll go. Then I'll do. The last critical issue we want to talk to you about in this group of discussions is really about moving Oregonians from poverty to prosperity. This is our work with the Department of Human Services on aligning programs. But it's not just aligning with state agency work. It's also aligning work at the local level with community organizations. WorkSource can't simply meet all the needs of the variety of targeted occupations out there, or targeted populations. We have to do it in concert and simultaneously with community-based organizations. And that longer-term client support jointly between WorkSource and those partners will, I believe, help us get a better result. I told you earlier I was going to talk briefly about targeted populations. There's a very long list of populations we are required by law to target. The head of that list is veterans. Veterans receive preference in everything WorkSource does. But it also includes TANF recipients, people of communities of color, people with disabilities. It is a very, very long list. We're asking our local partners to tell us which of those populations they're going to especially focus on during a given period to help us all work together in understanding how we adapt those sector strategies that we discussed earlier to make sure that target populations are not left behind while we do those sector strategies. And again, most of this work occurs at the local level. So it provides us with a little more focus.
Oregon's average all-industry wage is close to where it was in 1976. Oregon has the...
Okay.
Just a little teaser.
That was a teaser. Yeah. Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Christina Payne. I am the executive director with Lane Workforce Partnership. We're the local workforce board for Lane County. And what you're about to see and got a little taste of is a video that gives an overall view of what workforce boards do in each of your communities and basically what we're charged with and how that works on a high level. And then after the video, I'll speak more in detail, and it's a 3-minute video. So.
The second lowest graduation rate in the country. Rural Oregon is not yet rebounding from recession job losses. Who is working to address these kinds of challenges? Local workforce boards. Every county in Oregon is represented by a local workforce board. These business-led partnerships are primarily funded through the Federal Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act and chartered by the governor to better direct public workforce investments for talent development, job creation, and business competitiveness. The boards set the convening table and bring together private business with partners from local government, education, organized labor, economic development, and community-based organizations. The primary goal is to build a workforce system that is flexible, customer-focused, and responsive to local needs. They elevate the voice of business to articulate workforce needs and inform investments and strategies to meet those needs and to ensure alignment and the efficient use of resources to achieve better outcomes. Supply skills development so workers can fill current and emerging high-wage, high-demand jobs. Support youth so they have the academic and core competencies required by employers. Respond to the needs of employers so they have the skilled workers they need. Using labor market data and analysis, local workforce boards broker services in their communities to meet these goals. Services and investments are organized around sector partnerships, which target regional industries essential to local economies. Local boards invest in WorkSource Oregon as the primary vehicle for delivering workforce services across the state. In partnership with the Oregon Employment Department and other agencies, WorkSource Oregon helps customers learn new skills, find employment, and progress in careers, while also assisting employers with recruitment and retention of qualified, skilled employees. The majority of youth served are low income, with complex barriers to employment. Youth Services connect participants to career opportunities, training, and one-on-one support in order to prepare them for post-secondary education and career ladder employment. Youth gain the essential skills needed to be successful and self-sufficient. Oregon's local workforce boards are essential to economic prosperity and thriving communities. They are committed to continuous improvement and are accountable for providing high-performing systems that yield a maximum return on investment. Investing in human potential. Responding to the needs of business. Creating opportunities for growth. Find out more at OregonWFPartnership.org.
She's very talented.
Wish we could draw that
figure. Yeah.
He's good. Yes, if I can only draw it all. Chair Reed, again, my name's Christina Payne, and I'm the Executive Director with Lang Workforce Partnership. And I'm here to talk about how some of these initiatives take place on the ground. And so if you look at our mission is to meet the needs of employers and individuals through partnership and innovation. So you think, okay, so what exactly does that mean? We have two sides. We have an employer side and a job seeker side. And we want to treat those both with the kind of respect that we are meeting the needs of employers and job seekers in a way that builds up both so that individuals have the skills that are needed by businesses and businesses can recruit the talent, the local talent in our area. We start with the data. A lot of the different tables that you saw this morning, that's a place of starting point. And then as you also quickly noticed, it doesn't tell the whole story. So locally, we start digging into the data and pulling things apart where occupations were blended together. And so now how do we get down to what the real story is? And then we start meeting with employers locally to find out, here's what the data is telling this. Is this really true for your industry? Is this the right story? If we were to invest in a certain training for a certain occupation, would this really meet your needs? An example of how that's worked in our region is years ago, back about 2001, the data was showing us that there's a nursing shortage, a critical nursing shortage in our region. So we brought together Peace Health Hospital, Mackenzie Willamette, and Peace Harbor Hospital together, along with some long-term care facilities, and talked to them, showed them all the data that we had, and had them reflect upon it. And yes, there was definitely a nursing shortage, but there were other things that the data was telling us that wasn't quite accurate. The licensed practical nurses, it looked to us that we should be training a lot more, where in fact the hospitals were no longer hiring licensed practical nurses. So it was really key and critical to us to hear directly from them where our investments should be made. So we did a number of things. We expanded the nursing program at the local community college with some additional funds that we had received. And we worked with and received other grants and put individuals, staff in HR departments within the hospitals to identify people that were working in things like laundry, food services, and identified a career pathway for them and started working with individuals to move them up into positions that were in high need and then backfilling those positions with entry-level workers who needed those types of skills so that they too could move up along a career pathway. we also identified a distance program for a lab. And medical technologists were identified. They didn't come up in the data. And we soon realized the reason they didn't show in the data is because there wasn't enough numbers to actually be reflected in the data. But as Lisa was mentioning, sometimes there are those critically skilled jobs that if an industry doesn't have, then they can't even exist at all. So medical technologists were one of those skills, and we were able to identify through the Medical College of Georgia a distance program that is in place today in our community so that medical technicians, when they're ready, can train distance and become a medical technologist in our region. So these are the kinds of local conversations that happen and the local relationships that have to take place, the way we dig through the data. And a lot of this work does, over time, often become relationship-based. You start to hear about things that you would not hear about if you weren't right on the ground with people.
Okay. Excuse me just a second, Representative Wisdom.
Thank you. So who gave them the certificate? They took the distant learning class from Georgia or whatever, so they did get a certification. Did Oregon recognize out of that? Or did
yes.
They did. So Oregon nurses recognize that program online from Georgia.
So, Chair Reed and Representative Wisnant, it's the Medical College of Georgia. They received their training through that school and received documentation of they're a medical technologist. It's not a nursing certificate.
But Oregon recognized that.
Yes.
Good. Excellent. Thank you.
Please go ahead.
Good. And just to talk, I was going to go into the relationships that are created over time when you're working with HR and executives for so long and working with them on their workforce needs. There are times then when you actually receive a call, which I did, when an over-the-phone call Ask a Nurse program was going to be eliminated. And because these nurses had been working on the phone and hadn't been at the bedside, they weren't going to be qualified to go back to their old jobs. So we were able to acquire funds to be able to retrain them, recertify them to go back to the bedside. And it's things like that that happen on the ground that wouldn't normally be able to even take place. Those phone calls wouldn't be made. People probably wouldn't even think that they could make a phone call anywhere if they were laying off a certain workforce. And so those are the kinds of things that are important for us to be able to do on the ground. And so speaking of on-the-ground work, I will let Jennifer here introduce herself next, unless there's any other questions for me.
I don't think so. Thank you. Ms. Adams.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Adams, and I'm the HR director with Bulk Handling Systems located in Eugene, Oregon. We are a manufacturer of recycling systems, and we were unique that in 2008, when many businesses were shrinking because of the economic downturn, we were actually growing quite significantly. So as employees were walking out the door, we were able to grab them, bring them into our organization. So as you can imagine, there wasn't a lot of ramp up needed. These were highly skilled individuals that could step onto our shop floor, begin welding, fabricating with no issues, little training needed. So we went from about 35 employees to about 150 in that time frame. Come around about 3 years ago when I joined the organization in 2012, 2013, we were growing again. This time around, those individuals that had either left the area or they had retrained into different areas no longer existed in that welder fabrication area that we needed so desperately to continue to thrive as a business. Thankfully, I had attended a local Human Resources Association meeting where I got to meet one of the Lane Workforce Partnership members there, and they told us about the on-the-job training or Back to Work Oregon program. And this opened up a whole pool of individuals that we normally probably wouldn't even have looked at because we didn't know they existed. They may have been individuals that were underskilled, underemployed. Maybe they touched a welder while they were in high school once or twice, but they never got that opportunity to go out onto the shop floor and really learn that skill set. So through this program, we gained that pool, access to that pool. We were able to hire over 8 individuals last year through this program, which is fantastic. You may have heard them mention that employers get a reimbursement for hiring these individuals. We brought into the business not only those 8 individuals, those talented individuals, but about $27,000 to help reimburse for those wages while they were training. What we find even more exciting, however, though, is over the last 6 months, those eight individuals have made over $150,000. That is phenomenal to think that these individuals that may have been underemployed before, maybe minimum wage, are now bringing in wages that they can now provide for a family and grow their family. It's also inspired us to create an on-the-job training program within our organization that's outside of Lane Workforce Partnership, but again, we get to bring in individuals that have been with the company for multiple years, and they get to train these people. They get to show off their skills, so it created another career path for people within our business. Another exciting aspect of this program is through the CTE, or the youth services part of the Lane Workforce Partnership. Through one of the forums that Lisa mentioned, we got hooked up with Springfield High School. They have a phenomenal CTE program, drafting, welding, fabrication. These are right in our wheelhouse and what we need. We were actually able to hire two individuals out of this program, again, because they were 18 and older. We also got to participate on the job program. And because of this, they were individuals that hadn't had any work experience before, but we brought them in. Springfield High School also focuses on those business skills, or sometimes referred to as soft skills. They teach them that, hey, you do have to dress professionally in the workforce. You do have to show up to work. Mom can't write you that note out when you don't want to show up to school or you're sick or whatever the case may be. Well, these individuals are doing very, very well. Our individual that's in our engineering, our drafting department, he is considered one of our top drafters. High school education, doing a great job. We have another individual. He came in as what we call a detailer. So starts out knocking rust off of steel. Doesn't sound glamorous, but now he's a welder fabricator. He's already been promoted in less than 6 months. These are 18-year-olds bringing in very good wages. So without these programs, I don't believe we would have been able to find these individuals, and we look forward to finding more just like them, because they are going to be our lifeblood. Those journeyman skill sets, they don't exist as often anymore in our world. We have a lot of individuals that are getting ready for retirement, and when the CTE programs go away in the high school, we have to figure out a way to find individuals that are willing to work on that manufacturing shop floor and learn those skills, which we're very willing to do. And with the additional help of these programs, it makes it even easier to bring it to our executive management team and be on board with it.
Thank you. Representative Rudin, anything on CTE there? Sounds like she's reading from your...
I want to go down to...
I want to come visit. To,
yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. We love visitors.
Representative Rudin is one of our biggest advocates for CTE. That's why I'm calling.
Do you know, by any chance, do they have a Skills USA organization at Springfield High School?
They do not. Representative Rudin, they do not. I asked that question also. I participated in that in high school also, and they have not yet set that up. But I have pushed them to do that.
Good. Keep pushing.
Yeah, very good. Any other questions? These two? Thank you very much. Very helpful to hear the perspective from the locals. And we're going to make another transition. Lisa's still staying in her spot. And we have some return guests, Connie Green, president from Tillamook Bay Community College, and Ben Cannon from the HEC.
Great. Representative Reed and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Connie Green, president of Tillamook Bay Community College, and I must love showing up in front of you to give you backgrounds of how community colleges connect with everything. That seems to be my role. And actually, it is a pretty exciting role. If you're at a rural community college, all these things come together so closely, because together you make it happen. The slide in front of you is about career pathways. And Oregon actually was a leader. Career pathways didn't exist. We created them because we wanted a way for our employers, working with local workforce boards and working with our career technical advisory committees, employers to have stackable certificates. How do you start with the beginning skill set? How do you keep adding to that to the point you can get to an associate's degree? So we were We feel great about it. We are part of a national effort. In fact, as Lisa was talking about the New Investment Act, there's a lot of career pathways embedded, and a lot of that research came out of Oregon. Community colleges see workforce really as core to our mission. And as you know from before, when I was here, we talked about how that fits. We have transfer and CTE and workforce, adult basic skills. And as Lisa was talking, we get to play in a lot of the areas, adult basic skills. We get to play in the high school connection with dual credit, accelerated learning. We get to work with CTE. We get to work with workforce. And workforce crosses all of those things. So we have advisory committees at the colleges that help us do this. We work with our local workforce investment boards. They may be separate people because each one of our CTE advisory committees are actually employers in that field who guide us. And the local workforce investment board, they also have active people. So when you're in a rural area, oftentimes you get to have these committees working together. Lisa mentioned the number of individuals served by workforce. So if you look at community colleges in 12-13, we serve a fairly large number of individuals in Oregon. Actually, it's larger than the universities serve for their first 4 years, and it's very close to what the workforce system serves. Why do we serve that many? It's the broad range. Adult basic skills, ESL, GED, CTE, lower division credit, contracted training. It creates this huge amount of people coming to us to say, what do I need? What can you help me with? And that's what we try to do. Lisa mentioned about what is the number one, two, and three issues of economic development. And it's really, in many ways, for community colleges, workforce training is about each one of those. So whether we're talking about, again, a GED, whether we're talking about transfer, CTE, or workforce, they're all about workforce. Most individuals coming to community colleges about getting the next skill so they can keep a job for their family. If I talk to you about the numbers, oftentimes in education we talk about the pipeline. Well, we work with the pipeline, but we also work with the 80% of the people who are currently working, not the 20% who are 18 and 19-year-old, but the 80% who are currently working, those incumbent workers. And that's where we end up actually playing a large role in workforce, because some of them it's about one skill. Some of them it's about a certificate and a career pathway. Some of them it's about a credential. Let's take phlebotomy. And for some of them it's a whole associate's degree. So we're really in the rural areas. And I guess the reason I get to come is Tillamook is one of the rurals and it's one of the smallest. Many times we are the only choice. When I used to work for another great community college called Chemeketa, there were more choices in the I-5 corridor. There's less choices in Tillamook. But these individuals in our community need the same opportunity. So you work actually in partnership with your local workforce investment board, WorkSource Oregon. I do not have a placement service. I use WorkSource Oregon. There's a way in rural communities where you partner together and you don't duplicate anything that you don't have to because you don't have the resources to do it. So these numbers here most likely reflect not only just what I do, but the other 16 community colleges in partnership with our workforce partners. Certificates, that middle 40. We had a grant from the Department of Labor, and we tracked from a 2011 to 2014, the number of credentials and certificates. So that CPCC stands for Career Pathway Certificate. LOTOY stands for less than a one-year certificate, just to get the language down. If you look at the number of credentials and certificate, there were 1,500 across the state to a little over 1,100 individuals. We also had recognized credentials. These were certifications, so it might be, it's usually a certification given by an industry. It's not given by the college. It's not a certificate. An industry gives it. And from that, we had almost 3,000 industry-recognized credentials to about 1,000 individuals. To us in this case grant, because all 17 community colleges got to participate, it was a great way to bring up the skill of Oregonians around the state because we assisted to get people in through the case grant, worked with our workforce partners. They help refer. We help do the training. Employers help do the referring as well. It was a great partnership. If you look at the next slide, I'm going faster to make sure Ben's got time. Adult basic skills, when Lisa was talking about the different areas of need, whether it's limited or semi-skilled, One of the largest areas in Oregon is the current workforce who do not have a GED, may not have the English language skills. How do you help skill them up so they can get to the next level? And we had a goal, if you look at a numbers of participants served in that, was 367. In the grant, we served 854 people. It sounds like not a lot over an extra period of time. Think about the individuals coming in. Most of them adult basic skills read at a kindergarten or less level. If you're in a GED, you have to already be reading at a 6th or 8th grade level. So as we put the numbers who succeeded, it's people who either went from almost no reading to a higher level to 6th grade to get through a GED. So these were the hardest to serve. And yet we were able to more than exceed our target and work with individuals to pick up those skill sets, which is important for our workforce because if you can grow those skill sets, we talked about backfilling at Lane. When they worked in the hospital with the health industry, if you can move someone out of an entry-level job into the next technician job, that's an important skill that we need in Oregon. Before I jump to the next slide, that Lisa did so great for me there, though, to do the skills, you're working with people, and you've asked about veterans. Well, Matt was a veteran. Came back to Tillamook Bay, had no idea what he wanted, didn't have a GED yet, had been in the military. So we had him take classes some when Tillamook was still with PCC and Tillamook. He wanted to become an X-ray technician. Wasn't sure why he wanted to do it. So we actually worked with our workforce partners ourselves, gave him a mentorship program with the local Adventist Health, paired with a mentor. They liked him so much. He was in his scrubs, had a badge, had a timesheet. He is now in the X-ray technician program at PCC because he found out he really liked it. Sometimes you have to help people find out what they can really do and like and how they fit. So that's an example of a veteran that needed the skill set, but where do you start? He was referred from our workforce, Workforce Oregon partner, worked with us. We had this adventure and a great adventure for his journey with him. The next one here is an example from Clackamas. And as we work with our workforce partners, sometimes we use federal money. Sometimes we use state money. Oftentimes we work with industry partners and we actually partner with their money. This happens to be a brand new one going to be released on March 5th. It's a new milling workshop put together by Clackamas Community College in Gossiger. This a Harding Bridgeport 5-time milling machine. And if you're into that, you know what this means. But what is exciting is that the industry partner knew they needed it. They're willing to share it with more than just themselves. So there'll be workshops for other people in the area who are into the milling manufacturing area. And that was a partner stepping forward. At Tillamook, we have an industrial maintenance technician program. It's also part of a youth apprenticeship in that category. So we have a youth apprenticeship program with the high school there. Our industry provides, it's our Hampton, Stimson, and the Creamery, provides half of the total cost for the program because they needed to scale up their workers. Francisco was a student who was actually working for a local employer. He did not have English as his native language. He had begun at the mill. Some of the mill thought, you know what? This guy really has got talent. They came to us. We worked with him to get his GED. He did that in about 2 months. Working with our career coach and the Source Oregon coach, we got him into the classes. The mill adjusted his work schedule. He now has he's got 25 credits he's earned in the past year. He's on his way to get his associate's degree. And it's because of the partnership. The partnerships that you're talking about, whether it's through a community college by itself, which is seldom by itself. It usually has an employer partner, our WorkSource Oregon partner, and our local workforce investment boards together put these programs together because it takes a little bit of all of us to make it happen. None of us have the resources by ourselves. And so when you look at this, you think about workforce. Community College believes that workforce are core to our mission. We believe we're a core partner. And usually in the rural areas, we're the primary provider of a lot of the training just because there are not other nonprofits in the areas or private proprietaries to provide it. And we value being that workforce partner. And I thank you for letting me come and share one more time about community colleges and workforce.
Thanks. We appreciate it. Other questions?
And Thanks, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, I'm the executive director for our Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Great to be back, and I will be brief. I think I'm batting cleanup, or maybe a few final words to Lisa. But we're drawing towards the end, and I have just a few slides. I think the speakers who have come before, especially Lisa and Connie, have really helped to stress the very important role played by higher education, along with other partners, in our larger workforce system, and in particular the role that's played by community colleges in very directly addressing workforce needs. Just underscore with this slide the need within higher education, and again particularly at the community college level, to scale up our efforts to train students, train Oregonians, prepare Oregonians for workforce needs. And I think some of the efforts that Connie described reflect the efforts that our colleges are making to do so with support from the state. We move to the next slide. We put together a task force earlier this year. It spent months, I guess, into last year, 2014, working in partnership between the HEC and the Oregon Workforce Investment Board to really wrap our hands around the middle 40 questions, and in particular, sort of the roles and responsibilities of the HEC, of CCWD, of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, where we had shared space, shared responsibilities, and how those would be deployed in helping meet workforce needs in the middle 40 in particular. That task force, like the HEC and the OEIB, endorsed a broad understanding of what counts for the middle 40, many of the things that Connie and others have touched on as being really central to workforce needs and central to the efforts of our community colleges, and listed those here. Go ahead. I'm a data person, and as perhaps you've gleaned from my previous presentations to you, and so I'll show you a little data in a moment. One of the things that this HEC and OWIB task force did was help us better appreciate the ways in which Lisa's department, the employment department with its very clear view of employer needs, and the HEC with its very clear view of what our colleges and universities are producing by way of certificates, degrees, and other experiences for students, ways we can put that data together. And I'll give you some examples just in the next couple of slides. Here, this is a HEC-based slide that just simply in aggregate shows sort of net production or total production of degrees and certificates by our public and private institutions. The top sort of part of each of these bars is the benefit that Oregon derives from migration into the state. So we draw better educated workers than we lose. Overall, and that's a net benefit. So this gives you sort of the aggregate production plus net migration of certificates and degrees at each and every level. We only count people here once, so somebody who has an advanced degree, I'm 95% this is true. I'm sorry, actually I should be 100%. I may need to double check this, but I believe we're only counting here people who have somebody who shows up in the advanced degree category is not also have a bachelor's degree.
Question for you, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Wisnett and I jumped ahead on the slides and noticed something that we'd like to clarify. Under associate degree, it says there's 1,110 in-state private associate degrees. What private institution awards an associate degree?
Representative McEwen, Chair Reed, that's a good question. I'll have to get back to you on that. We have a number of private colleges and universities, but associate's degrees we do associate with our community college.
Right.
IT&T, they have associate degrees as an example.
So these are private for profit.
Private, yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Is Phoenix also, Mr. Chair?
Representative Wisnett, Chair Reed, I'm not.
I don't think Phoenix has an associate's degree, but I could be wrong. We can double check. I think they just do their bachelor's and master's, but
you might want to break those out on that slide. It's a little bit confusing.
Yeah, Representative McEwen, Chair Reed, to take your point, we tend to think of the for-profits and the not-for-profits in different categories. This slide helps them all as in-state private.
Thank you so much.
And then the next slide, this is where we really begin to try to match these up, this data, this production data, up with what the employment department projections tell us about workforce needs. I showed you a version of this slide, I think, in my first presentation to this committee, and with a lot of caveats, because this data is very provisional. We don't quite know entirely what it means. But it again, attempts to take the employment department projections of job openings over the next 5 years and match them against the production data that I just showed you coming out of Oregon, private and public institutions. It does not account for the net migration in and out of Oregon. And it's an example. I would use this mostly to illustrate what may be possible by linking employment department data, really close relationships with employers, and what we know at the heck about production. Finally, and again, this is this is all coming from Lisa's shop, but their list of highest priority occupations based on total openings that require high levels of education. So these are the high priority and high wage, high demand occupations. You'll see each of these requires at least some level of post-secondary training. Many of them require bachelor's and advanced degrees. These are among the fields that have the greatest number of projected job openings over the next five-year period. At the HEC, our responsibility for approving new programs at our public universities and colleges, our responsibility for making budget recommendations to you for potential investment, our responsibility for allocating the dollars that you appropriate to colleges and universities is being exercised with a view towards the kinds of workforce needs that the employment department helps provide us a picture through their work with employers.
I have a question on this one. It looks like they're ranked by total openings, but on the left there's priority rank, which are not in order. How does the priority rank work?
Chair Reed and members of the committee, Lisa may be able to refer to that, since that is an OE, an employment department ranking that combines several factors. It's not, obviously, it's not just aggregate openings. I don't know, Lisa, if you recall precisely how that rank is developed. I believe, and if Graham Slater were here, he would be able to confirm, since that's where it comes from. I believe it also includes some measure of sort of proportional growth, as well as wage data, but we'd be happy to get back to you.
It'd be interesting. Other questions? Representative McEwen?
No.
Okay. I have another one if others don't. Can we go back to the slide, matching education to workforce, you had a couple minutes ago? So I'm interested in there's some pretty large mismatches in those numbers. And one thing that occurs to me, I was debating whether to ask earlier on about as people are pursuing and earning certificates and so on, the notion of, on the one hand, a certificate that is very specifically aimed at a specific job that would be good, but if that job or that opportunity isn't there in the future, to what degree does that certificate translate to other opportunities? So the sort of tension between a very specific one and a general kind of educational experience that can translate, and to what degree people are doing both at the same time. And then, as Representative Wisnant and I were talking about, does this suggest we're producing too many advanced degrees relative to opportunities? So a lot in that question.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, and Connie may have thoughts about this as well. First, to your latter point, it certainly does appear to suggest that we're overproducing in advanced degrees. However, I think the data is only particularly relevant if you start to drill down, which we are beginning to do at a degree by degree level. Right? I think it would be a mistake to say, don't get an advanced degree because there won't be a job. Well, advanced degree can be in so many different fields that I think it's probably not particularly instructive until you look down at a degree to degree level and which field the degree is obtained in. Your first question, I think higher ed generally, and I think those of us doing policy in and around higher ed are keenly aware of this tension between, on the one hand, supporting students in creating direct and immediate employment opportunities, right? And many of the training programs and certification programs that are linked very closely with a high need area in our economy is a great investment in, for a student and in a student. At the same time, I work, you know, obviously closely with people at our colleges and universities who care very much about ensuring that that student is prepared for a long-term future where in which the economy is changing. Yeah. And the certificate that may be valued today may not be the certificate that's valued tomorrow. I think that's part of the reason we saw the idea of stackable sort of credentials. Working in that vein to ensure that this is something that, that this credential is durable and enduring for a worker. It is something that can be translated or with additional training can translate to other opportunities.
And I, if you go back to slide 39, when you've got the career pathways and the less than 1 year, those are all the stackable ones so that you can keep growing. And our hope is that you don't lose the credits, you don't have to repeat something. The industry credential part of it, which is also part of that blue line, is not necessarily directly aligned with that certificate. It could be a subset of that. And so we're trying really hard to work with employers about the industry recognized credentials and employers designing those stackable careers, and they're not always identical. And so you try to really look at that employer, what they need in that market that you're serving. So when you go back to the certificate, I can see why people would like more. It's that entry level skill. How do I get you started? If I take the welding and the company who's looking, some of those are certificates, they're not degrees. So how do you build those out? I also get that on these associate's degrees, you know, it says the projected openings. Well, for many of our associate degrees individuals, it's how they get started to go on to the bachelor's degree, and they work in between with that. So sometimes it might look like we're overproducing, but really you're creating the next step so they can keep moving. So part of this is, what does that person need in that community they live in? All of your communities are different, to keep on moving. And at the same time, have something to show to an employer, I have this skill. And that's the blend we're trying to walk, I think, for all of us, is I have the skill, I can meet an employer need, and I can keep growing it based on what I need to do. And so some of those are embedded with each other as well.
That's a very good discussion. Thank you. Other questions from
anyone? I just want to point out, I mean, I was, as you were describing that, it just made me think of another level or standard, which is licensing. I mean, how many of our folks who go through these educational processes and then have to take a license in order to get into a particular profession or something.
Any others?
Any question?
Representative,
it's kind of a crossover. Thank you. Crossover question from another committee. Thank you, Chair Reed. I noticed your medical technology med tech is number 2 on their bachelor's, number 11 on associates, so fairly high on the Oregon Department of Education or Oregon Employment Department's ranking. When the legislature makes decisions, like we in healthcare, we have a House bill on whether it should actually be a nurse or a med tech on a blood bank, how do those types of decisions interact with what you're trying to do and investments that you've put in to try and build up a certain workforce as, you know, requirements change? Can you speak to that at all? Or,
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, I guess if the question is how sort of legislative thinking and decisions around these professions reflects the type of data that we've described here, I think I can only say we'd be very happy to help inform. And I'm leaning almost entirely on Lisa's agency for this data, but I expect that she or my agency would be happy to help inform that that decision making. In terms of, I mentioned previously some of the ways that we at the agency level and at the HEC level specifically are beginning to look to this data to help reflect our recommendations to you around budget, so potential strategic investments where there may be a particularly high-need field that we appear to be underproducing in. Perhaps it would be appropriate for us to bring to you, I mean, this is the type of conversation mm-hmm. we're having at a commission level, bring to you recommendations for strategic investment that you, through your budget process, may make. Program approval, when we have a community college or a university who brings to us, says, we want to start a new program in X, Y, or Z, this is the type of data that we look at to say, yes, that makes a lot of sense because it's clearly meeting a high workforce need. That's work that they've typically done at a local level already to ascertain. We can check that against the data that we keep at the state. Yeah.
I think we also, Chair Reed and Representative Hayden, through our local sector strategies, these issues are very clearly addressed. And so I worked on a local sector strategy in healthcare where the local hospitals and healthcare providers said, stop training medical assistants. We have more than we need. And the tension in the system is that our healthcare providers, and this was in another state, our education providers really liked training medical assistants because it was a quick program, and local people want quick programs so mm-hmm. that they can get out there and start working. And that's why Connie's discussion of stackable credentials is so important. The medical assistant program in that state was not stackable. If you wanted to do anything else, if you wanted to become a med tech, you had to go back and start from zero. Yeah, okay. So to the extent we can get short-term programs where you can start working and then go back and add to it and have employers offer incentives and on-ramps to make that additional training happen, whether it's through distance learning or classes in a local community college or apprenticeship, we need to make things add up to that next thing. So we could say to someone, we want you to be a med tech, but it might take them 4 years. They don't want to talk about it. But we can help them talk about the stackable credentials.
Thank you.
Representative McEwen.
Chair Reed, this opens a whole door to a conversation that is best served another day. But in work that I've done in the past, this issue became critically important in educating young people about transferable credit, which enters into the stackable certificate world. There are areas where you can go and be certified at a base level of learning, be in that profession for a period of time, and then want to go to the next step. And if it's not transferable credit to a community college or beyond, all of a sudden the student has to go back to the bottom and start over. And I can give you a number of examples. But that's a topic that I haven't heard quite addressed here that is really significant for a lot of young people who are making investments in programs and people who are coming back into the workforce or trying to change careers where they've spent a lot of money and invested, and it is for naught when they want to go to that next step. So yeah. It's a very significant topic of conversation in educating people.
It is. The Chair Reed, members of the committee, it is. And it becomes more so because of the federal financial aid laws
yes.
that limit things. So when we talk about accelerated learning and credits at the high school for the college, one of the things we're trying really hard to work at is what will count no matter what versus what will count because it's a college or career credit. The other part of it is there's some amazing career technical programs. So in those career technical programs, if you start at the high school and you take the right courses, continue at the community college, do the pathways, whatever, you can get an associate's degree. The value of the Applied Baccalaureate is taking that associate's degree in a career technical area, and the Applied Baccalaureate the universities have is then you go ahead and get a bachelor's degree. You don't lose anything because it's now about the taking it to the next level. It's usually around a management skill, around a technical area. There are things in Oregon that we're doing that are right. There are some things in Oregon that we are trying to fix that weren't right. So you're right. Having credits count is real important, and it affects your federal financial aid. It affects what's happening. But I think most of us in this industry are seeing the changes, so how do we help? You start the high school and you educate there, and you also help when students enter. You try to make sure they have a plan. It used to be you could come to community college and try some things out. Still happens, but we try really hard. What's your plan? Because if you use up 12, 24, 36, pick your number of learning, you only have, in essence, most of your associate's degrees is 90 credits. You can only go half over that, so we're talking about getting to about 140 credits at the most, and you can no longer continue getting that federal financial aid. So how do we help you do that wisely? And so you're right on. Those are real issues, and I think it'd be a great conversation of things we're trying, the strategies we're using, the connections.
Thank you.
Thanks for that. Any concluding comments?
Mr. Chair, Representative McHugh, I just want to, it's such an important topic, and it's a primary reason, I believe, for the existence of a coordinating commission that can, not through the imposition of standards, but through the convening of our institutions, can try to ensure that there is greater credit transferability. You also have at least one, maybe several bills that are on this topic, and we'd be happy to come and talk to you about some of the strategies that the commission believes we can use to increase the likelihood that credits not only are earned, but are meaningful and useful.
Thank you.
We want that. Thank you very much. We appreciate the hearing and the good orientation to workforce issues. We'll close the informational hearing. And unless there's anything else to come before the committee, we'll see you on Wednesday. We're adjourned.
Thank you.